Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Filmon, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And I want to thank you for joining me today. And as always, I have enlightening guests and enlightening conversations, and this is no exception, so stay tuned. If you are listening for the very first time, I personally want to welcome and thank you for joining me. I invite you to go to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, or you can go to my website, drcherylfilmon.com, because I post all the archive shows either on my Facebook page or I send them out through my website to you directly, so you won't miss them. And one way or the other, you'll be able to get all of the programs I do. I actually have another program on Progressive Radio Network called The Love Code, which has a more spiritual orientation. And if you like me over at What Women Must Know or opt into Dr. Cheryl Filmon, that show gets sent to you as well. So you'll have lots of great listening ahead and lots of great learning. Let's talk about our topic for today's show. And we're going to be exploring how our endocannabinoid system supports our overall well-being with my guest, Carl Germano. And I'd like to just share a little bit about Carl with you. He is a New York board certified clinical nutritionist and vice president of Verdant Oasis. He holds a master's degree in clinical nutrition from New York University and has over 40 years experience as VP of product development for several of the largest vitamin supplement companies in the trade. In addition, he has been instrumental in bringing cutting-edge nutritional materials and finished product formulations to a variety of markets, including dietary supplements, medical foods, and functional beverages in the health food trade, medical and mass channels. Today, with Verdant Oasis, he continues his efforts in product development and research and is responsible for providing the industry with the next generation of clinically important phytocannabinoid ingredients such as CBD and others. Previously, he had spearheaded the new phytocannabinoid initiative for Energetics and now for Verdant Oasis, a major grower, developer, cultivator, and extractor of multi-spectrum phytocannabinoid-rich hemp oil. Prolific author with several best-selling trade books including The Misled Athlete, Nature's Painkillers, The Osteoporosis Solution, The Brain Wellness Plan, and his most recent book is Road to Ananda, The Simple Guide to the Endocannabinoid System, Phytocannabinoids, and Your Health. So, wow, we have Carl Germano with us, a busy guy.
Thank you so much.
I just want to say thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful having you, and so glad you were able to give us some time today because obviously you're a busy guy. You have so much going and very exciting work that you're doing, and that's why I'm thrilled to have you, because you're one of the most knowledgeable people about the world of hemp and the endocannabinoid system, and we're going to talk about phytocannabinoids and all of the benefits that this amazing plant has given to us. So Carl, let's just start. I'd like to ask you, what is it that got you attracted to the world of hemp, the hemp plant, the endocannabinoid system, and this whole exploding area that's really having such an impact to our to many industries, actually. It has many, many facets of use, the hemp plant that we're talking about does.
Sure. Well, you know, being a clinical nutritionist and a progressive one, I've always been involved in botanical medicine and incorporated into many of the protocols that I used in clinical practice in the past. I've got to appreciate botanical medicine even furthermore. Post my master's degree, I studied Chinese herbology and acupuncture and got to truly understand and appreciate the major medicinal modalities that existed thousands of years ago, traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, all talked about the potpourri of ingredients that you find in a plant collectively, how they are becoming most important to the clinical relevancy of what that plant does in the human body. And is no different here to probably one of the most important plants that we have called hemp. And so when I started to practice and I started to learn, and my mentors were really brilliant minds who talked a lot about how this collective of synergistic ingredients in plants have better clinical outcome when applied collectively as opposed to when you're trying to pull a single one out. And this is similar to the story that has been evolving over the past 6-7 years, and the story about CBD, which to me is just very old news and a very myopic story, because it just represents one of over 100 different cannabinoids found in hemp. And so, with that said, I think it's most important that people truly understand, first and foremost, the difference between hemp and marijuana. Both are considered cannabis sativa botanically by genus and species. But that's where the similarity ends. Marijuana has been cultivated for the primary cannabinoid we know as THC, tetrahydrocannabinol, which we know has intoxicating value, so it's got recreational value. We also know at very small doses, THC has tremendous medicinal value as well. But we're going to put that to the side because this is a regulated plant, and we're now going to look at hemp. Poor hemp. It had to be in the same family as marijuana, cannabis sativa. And because of that, many, many, many decades ago, it was dumped into the Controlled Substances Act and was treated as if it was marijuana. But it has nothing at all in terms of its similarity to marijuana, because from a chemical point of view, the major cannabinoid found in hemp is not intoxicating like THC. It's called CBD. But let's go even further, and we see that there are over 100 different cannabinoids in hemp. Now, hemp is not new to us, and hemp should never have been in the Controlled Substances Act, which, thank goodness, in December of 2018, it was taken out. Under the Food Farm Bill of 2018, it was taken out, and it's not regulated as a drug because it's not, and it's not going to get you high, and people need to be more educated about this plant. This plant is probably the most important agricultural plant we have on this planet. It's been used thousands of years medicinally, but we also know, and we've used it in this country, food, clothing, fiber, fuel. There are building materials made from hemp, like hemp concrete called hempcrete, which is more carbon negative. Jay Leno featured a car on his car show that the shell was completely made from hemp nano sheets, and which are stronger than steel. There are plastics made from hemp, leading to better sustainability and what have you. And back in the 50s, for World War II, in this country, there was a Hemp for Victory campaign to encourage farmers to grow hemp because of the ropes and textiles that can be gotten from it. But it wasn't until about 6-7 years ago where we started to get to understand and appreciate some of these active medicinal compounds we find in hemp called phytocannabinoids. And Dr. Sanjay Gupta ran 3 one-hour specials on CNN years ago looking at children who have Dravet syndrome or epileptic seizures. And with the application of, you know, a rich CBD cannabis material, those 300 to 400 seizures a week went down to maybe one. It was quite dramatic. It brought light to the importance of this plant from a medicinal standpoint. And that's rather tragic in a sense, because when we look at the past history, we've been involved in this perfect storm, this botanical travesty of how hemp has been treated or mistreated, and then the medical travesty of how the cannabinoid system in the body has been ignored since its discovery in the 1990s. And both of these have been colliding to the point where today we have dismantled the stigma attached to cannabinoids and hemp, and we've gotten to understand that these phytocannabinoids, these active compounds found in hemp, like CBD, are profoundly effective from a medicinal point of view in so many ways, because the endocannabinoid system, which was discovered in the 1990s, represents the most important physiological system in our body. It touches every organ system. It modulates every function of every organ system. And from a global perspective, it's there to maintain health, well-being, and balance, what we know as homeostasis. Excuse me. The brains behind the discovery, Dr. Raphael Meshulam out of Hebrew University in Jerusalem, and his colleagues out of the National Institutes of Mental Health here, Devane, Howard, Herkimer, and others, these were your major players. And what we discovered in the 1990s is that we have receptors, these little windows on the cells of our bodies that let things in. These receptors that accept cannabinoids. And the first thing you have to ask yourself is, well, with these receptors found everywhere on every organ system influencing its activity, the body must be making something to influence or target these receptors. And in the late 1990s, we discovered we actually produce two cannabinoids. That's right. I tell the world, you're going to have to just get over it. You produce cannabinoids similar to cannabinoids found in cannabis, and your body feeds off of them. And when you don't produce enough, this cannabinoid deficiency state exists and is tied into many interesting illnesses, migraines, fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, inflammatory, neurological diseases. There are many of these conditions where we actually see low levels of the cannabinoids we produce. The two cannabinoids we produce, one is called anandamide, ananda from the Sanskrit word meaning bliss, because anandamide hits the same receptors that THC targets. And we know THC is intoxicating, anandamide is so much less so, but we know that anandamide absolutely affects mood, behavior, is involved in basically consciousness. And so they named it anandamide because it hits the receptors that cause good feelings. As a matter of fact, for the sports enthusiasts out there, this notion that runner's high is due to endorphins, they're going to have to rethink their thinking, because it's anandamide levels that skyrocket after strenuous activity that hit receptors that make you feel good. And there are many articles and research papers that have been written to dismantle the endorphin story. It's all about the endocannabinoid system and the cannabinoids we produce. The other cannabinoid is called 2-AG, which stands for 2-arachidonyl glycerol. So we produce these two cannabinoids, and they touch every organ system, and they do many things. The unfortunate part is they are lipids. They're produced from fats in the body, but they're taken up and they're broken down rapidly. So we have to be aware of things that can make these two cannabinoids lower in the body to get to points where we are deficient, which translates and to many conditions that will ensue. Now, when you target the receptors we have in our body, they elicit many different physiological responses, controlling blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, pain, what have you. But we also know that the cannabinoids we produce are quite promiscuous and that they also influence other receptors, like the TRP receptors, GABA, 5-HT3, which have overlapping roles in maintaining, controlling anxiety to inflammation and pain and what have you. And so we have to come to terms with the fact that we have what I call cannabinatomy. We have all of our organ systems that have these receptors for cannabinoids. that help regulate their functional roles in the body. And when it comes to functional roles, if we start from the top down, in the brain, there are heavy concentrations of cannabinoid receptors, and they're found in parts of the brain, interestingly enough, that control movement, cognition, appetite, learning, memory, stress, pain control. And when we look at data out there, it's not just CB1 receptors, but we also have CB2 receptors that get signal to reduce further damage to the brain. And there are some excellent articles, one in Frontiers of Neuroscience in 2017, of looking at analysis of brains of memory-challenged individuals showing an upregulation of these cannabinoid receptors to help protect the brain and prevent the degradation of the cannabinoids we produce. Back in 2003 in CNS Drugs, we got to look at the big picture of all of these cannabinoid receptors in the central nervous system, where they're located. But then when we looked at the functionality, it was just mind-blowing. I mean, memory storage, motor function, posture, balance, movement control, pain signaling to the brain, thermal regulation, neuroendocrine release, immunity, intraocular pressure in the eye, bronchodilation in the lungs, and the list just continues to go on and on and on as we've experienced that the endocannabinoid system governs neurotransmission in the brain and insulin sensitivity and bone building, which I'll get to in a second, and many other physiological functions. You know, it's interesting when we talk about on the neurological side, back in 2003, the United States government Department of Health and Human Services was issued a patent on the neuroprotective effects of cannabinoids. So while our dear old government has been telling us that cannabinoids are like LSD and heroin and there's no medical value, they go out and get a patent on the medical value. But what's interesting about this patent, it was a combination and culmination of all the data that exists on the neuroprotective effects of cannabinoids in the brain, how these cannabinoids can prevent further damage to the brain after stroke or trauma, or their usefulness in neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, on down. And there's a lot of data in this area that's very exciting. I mean, you look at GW Pharmaceuticals that has two drugs, one that was approved by FDA, to treat epilepsy in children because we know how it decreases excitatory behavior in the brain. But when we look at the whole host of data out there, we know that both anandamide and 2-AG help to reduce edema in the brain, cell death, inflammation, oxidative stress in the brain, things that we see are hallmarks of most neurological diseases. And then you have a whole bunch of studies that were produced, that were actually published in various journals in neuropsychopharmacology and what have you, how cannabinoids have been shown to have neuroprotective properties, reducing inflammation, promoting neurogenesis, the development of new brain cells. They prevent the release of glutamate, which is a toxic chemical in the brain that can damage brain cells. In Alzheimer's disease, in vitro studies show that it helps clear the amyloid plaques that are related to the development of Alzheimer's disease. And even with CBD, it's been shown to reduce the expression of certain genes that are implicated in these what we call neurofibrillary tangles, this clumping up of brain cells and what have you that can lead to, you know, damaged memory and what have you. There's a lot of work that's been published on neuroinflammation in the brain and how cannabinoids and the endocannabinoid system modulates this effect. And then we look at other aspects in the brain, people who have migraines. In Neuropsychopharmacology 2007 and even in 2019, which was a review paper about the endocannabinoid system in migraines, we now note that people who have migraine headaches have statistically significant decreases in anandamide levels in both the blood and cerebral spinal fluid compared to controls. And there's growing evidence, both initial clinical findings that the modulation of our endocannabinoid system by using phytocannabinoids may be very relevant for migraine treatment and help. When it comes to stress and anxiety, there's a whole host of papers that show that it is well established that the endocannabinoid system plays a role in the regulation of stress response and in the development of stress-induced psychiatric disorders. We know both anandamide and 2-AG help terminate the stress response in the body. And there was an interesting paper in Translational Psychiatry 2014 that looked at anandamide levels and how they can predict stress-induced anxiety. When they get too low, they become statistically significant, literally biological markers to show that stress is on its way when anandamide levels get too low. And so even in Journal of Basic Clinical Physiological Pharmacology in 2018 showed us both preclinical and clinical data relating stress-related challenges that are associated with both neurotransmission in the brain and decreased endocannabinoid tone, which means decreased anandamide and 2-AG levels, the ones that we produce in our body. We see papers published in the literature to treat post-traumatic stress disorder. We know that the circulating levels of cannabinoids we produce are markedly decreased in PTSD. We see papers that where people who are administered stressful public speaking tests, given just CBD, how it treats their anxiety and what have you. But what we've been able to unravel was the fact that the endocannabinoid system can help reduce this fear, anxiety, and extinct aversive memories, and why it becomes so useful in post-traumatic stress disorder. There was one particular study in Biological Psychiatry 2019. It was a double-blind placebo-controlled trial looking at the use of compounds to help prevent the breakdown of our cannabinoids. Showed a tenfold increase in anandamide levels, which helped to protect against stress-induced negative fear, emotions, and memories. So we know PTSD is just persistent fear memories and maladaptive stress responses, and that's why it's been so helpful. When it comes to inflammation, if you think curcumin, boswellia, fish oils, and quercetin are good anti-inflammatory nutrients, which they are, they enter the pathways, well, they will have to contend with the endocannabinoid system because the endocannabinoid system is the system that controls and modulates all of the pathways involved in inflammation and pain. And there was a great paper in Current Opinions in Clinical Nutrition and Metabolic Care back in 2014, the endocannabinoid system, how it's an emerging player, key player in inflammation. But then it went on and back and up until 2019, two papers, interestingly enough, produced in Advances in Pharmacology and Neuropsychopharmacology, looking at endocannabinoids, their pain sites, their mechanism of action. And we've got to understand and appreciate the analgesic and anti-inflammatory effects that the cannabinoids have in our body. When we come to this wonderful gut-brain-immune connection that everyone has been talking about over the past 10 years, well, about 30 years ago, my first book, The Brain Wellness Plan, I had a whole chapter on the gut-brain-immune connection, and that's how important it was. We know that this tri-directional communication between the brain, the gut, and the immune system to keep the whole body healthy. We understand the brain pushes out neurotransmitters to talk to the immune system and the gut. We know the immune system pushes out immunotransmitters that talks to the brain and the gut. Then we have the gut, which we traditionally have always thought was an organ of digestion, but got to truly appreciate the fact that it's littered with hundreds of millions of immune cells because it's our largest immune organ, and rightfully so. We keep dumping in pathogens and toxins every single day when we eat, and that gut has to recognize friend from foe and whether or not to launch an attack or not. So we got to understand that the gut is the major immune organ in the body. But dig a little bit deeper, and you're going to find there are hundreds of millions of neurons in the gut. That's right, brain cells. So the next time you have a gut feeling, understand your gut is your second brain. As a matter of fact, during fetal development, the cells that build the brain branch off to build the intestinal tract, all connected by the vagus nerve. So your gut is both your brain and your immune system located in a different area of the body, and we must keep that healthy in order to control the rest of the body. Now, what does this have to do with the cannabinoid system in the body? Well, in gastroenterology back in 2016, there was a great paper, The Role of the Endocannabinoid System in the Brain-Gut Axis. We now know the endocannabinoid system controls the motility of the gut, intestinal inflammation. It helps link the stress and abdominal pain. It reduces the activity of the stress pathways, like the HPA pathways. And so there have been a lot of interesting papers produced. In the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2017, how anandamide plays pivotal roles in maintaining immunological health in the gut, and how the endocannabinoid system controls inflammation and disruptions in permeability. And so we've always known that the endocannabinoid system controls gastric secretions, contractibility, signaling in the gut, and on and on and on. And then they've uncovered this beautiful relationship between the endocannabinoid system and the microbiome. There is extensive research linking the endocannabinoids in intestinal health with the intestinal microbiome, your probiotics and what have you, healthy bacteria, and that when you dysregulate the endocannabinoid system, it can lead to inflammatory conditions of the intestinal tract, like inflammatory bowel disease. And so there's a lot going on in this area as well. The last two areas I want to hit before we actually talk about hemp and why we need to take hemp is the area of bone health. Now, we know and appreciate that calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, menaquinone 7, boron and a couple of accessory nutrients are all important for the health structurally of hard bone. But what do we look to do in postmenopausal women that we give these nutrients to and they still lose bone mass? What we got to appreciate over the years, of the decades actually, is the role of hormones that affect cells that build up and break down bone from the day we're born to the day we die. These cells, one is called osteoclasts. These are cells that break down bone. And the other are called osteoblasts, cells that build up bone. And your bone is constantly breaking down and rebuilding and breaking down and rebuilding, again, throughout your entire life. And it's the role of osteoclasts that break down bone, and then the osteoblasts to rebuild those bones. Now, as we get older, and especially for women postmenopausal, when estrogen levels drop, the level of osteoblasts that build up bone starts to dramatically decrease. And the level of osteoclasts that build up, that break down bone, increase. And so we have to deal with those two types of cells in addition to the structural components of bone like calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, menaquinone 7, on and on and on. Well, we know that estrogen therapy helps in this manner, but we also understand that there are major risk factors with estrogen therapy and hormonally dependent cancers. I've written my second book, The Osteoporosis Solution, that talked about ipraflavone, which is an isoflavone found in soy that works like estrogen in terms of affecting osteoclasts and osteoblasts, but does not have the cancer effects. And then we come to the endocannabinoid system. We now know that in a great paper in Journal of Neuroendocrinology 2008, endocannabinoids and the regulation of bone metabolism. We now know when you hit the cannabinoid receptors, they do two things. First, they can communicate with the brain and say, hey, stop pushing out these compounds that are breaking down bone like norepinephrine. But more importantly, there's another type of cannabinoid receptor called CB2 in the bone that when you activate those, It stimulates bone formation by increasing osteoblasts and suppresses bone breakdown by decreasing osteoclasts. Similar to what estrogen would do, with no estrogenic effects. So in order to treat osteoporosis, osteopenia, low bone density, people who, or young people who fracture bones, you want to rebuild bone, you've got to work with the osteoclasts and osteoblasts, and you must work with the endocannabinoid system, not just give the structural components like calcium, magnesium, on and on, as I mentioned. The last thing I just want to quickly mention is that the fact that the endocannabinoid system is also key in controlling and being very much involved in consciousness, which is a phenomenal area that it is evolving. And we classically view consciousness as thoughts, feelings, perceptions around us that organize our behavior. Neuroscientists will look at certain sets of action or communication amongst neurons to produce perceptions and what have you. So no matter how you look at it, when you look at the congregation of cannabinoid receptors and cannabinoids in the brain that are governing neurotransmission, that are governing parts of the brain that are involved in learning and memory and cognition and what have you, the level of consciousness that constantly shifts basically is all influenced by our endocannabinoid system. And there's some really interesting papers where they anesthetize rats, put them in a somewhat unconscious state, and how manipulating the endocannabinoid system takes them out of that. The bottom line is, every conscious thought, perception, and feeling, everything we think of or do is influenced in one way, shape, or form by the cannabinoid system in the body. And so in subtle ways, your endocannabinoid system helps to form your personality, helps you think clearly, focused. Are you laid back, relaxed, or anxious? Are all due to the endocannabinoid system and its regulatory roles in the body. So with all that said, like anything else that we produce in the body, sometimes we don't produce enough. It could be a medical condition, it could be age, it could be a medication, it could be poor diet, it could be stress, and the cannabinoids we produce are no different. And we now know that there are things called endocannabinoid deficiency states. And in two papers published in Neuroendocrinology Letters back in 2014 and 2008, talking all about how endocannabinoid deficiencies play a major role in fibromyalgia, irritable bowel syndrome, migraines, inflammatory and neurological diseases that could be suitably treated with dietary phytocannabinoids, which we're going to get to. And there are several papers that look at this beautiful and intimate relationship from a dietary standpoint, that if you are omega-3 deficient, you will be endocannabinoid deficient, meaning that omega-3 fatty acids we know from fish oils. What do they have to do with our endocannabinoid system? Well, when we are omega-3 deficient, the cannabinoid receptors are not as active, and more importantly, omega-3s are used as backbone structures to produce anandamide and 2-AG, the cannabinoids in our body. So it behooves us to make sure that we get a sufficient level of cannabinoids in our diet, and we do that two ways. One, with omega-3s, but more importantly, the other way is to look at the most concentrated source of phytocannabinoids that can support our endocannabinoid system, and that is hemp. So in order to support the endocannabinoid system, we must talk about hemp, and we must focus on this more important story about the phytocannabinoids, all of them that are found in hemp, not just CBD, and how they nourish and support the endocannabinoid system. So this single magic bullet, myopic CBD story needs to go away. It's a ridiculous story which is not based on science or law for us to even be bothered with. If we've learned anything from Eastern medicine, we understand that botanicals contain more than one single compound. And I can make the case, is there more than one ginsenoside in ginseng? No, there are dozens. Is there more than one curcuminoid in curcumin? No, there are over a dozen. Is there more than one ginkgolide in ginkgo? No, there are many. Is there more than one isobutylamide in echinacea? No, there are many. No different here. Hemp has over 100 cannabinoids, of which CBD is one of them. At the top of the list, the cannabinoid that acts like a stem cell in hemp, from which all other cannabinoids are made, is called cannabigerol, or CBG. I go down the list, and there's an important cannabinoid called beta-caryophyllene, which attaches to cannabinoid receptors that CBD does not. And so we have to understand and appreciate hemp as a botanical plant and its complete class of phytocannabinoid compounds of being the most important story to be told. And that in terms of clinical efficacy, if you want to benefit from hemp and nourish and support the endocannabinoid system, you must take in the full family of phytocannabinoids because CBD alone cannot support the endocannabinoid system by itself. And so we must stay away from these characters who are trying to follow the coattails of GW Pharmaceuticals, who brought light to CBD and epilepsy, and so did CNN, and right away the money signs and everybody was just focusing on CBD. Completely an ignorant viewpoint of the importance behind this plant. Which then brings us to what do you look for in the marketplace? And while CBD is a single magic bullet, we now know the literature will show that CBD on its own compared to what we call full spectrum plant, whole plant extracts do not compare from clinical outcome standpoint. As a matter of fact, whole spectrum plant extracts fare much better in terms of clinical outcome. And they don't have this dose response curve that single magic bullet CBD has, that if you give too much, it starts to lose its effectiveness. You don't see that with the full plant spectrum material. And this was beautifully written about in the British Journal of Pharmacology in August of 2011 by Dr. Ethan Russo. That talked about the entourage effect, the sum being greater than the parts. And he was referring specifically to all of the phytocannabinoids and plant compounds that have this synergism to give rise to its full, meaningful benefits in the human body. And so for that reason, I tell people that we need to look at a number of things when you're looking to benefit from a hemp material. You're going to look for products that have full spectrum. You're going to look at products where you can actually ask for the strains of hemp that they've been using. And the reason why I focus on this is because in the United States, we've been in the Stone Ages for the past 80 to 100 years. We've locked up hemp, and we couldn't commercialize it, cultivate it, or consume it for that long. Whereas in Europe and Israel, thank God for them, it's been the complete opposite. So they have true strains of hemp that have not been genetically manipulated where materials can be produced from. So you would look for strains that you can find right on the EU Commission's website of strains of hemp that have been used for humans for decades, as opposed to a lot of stuff that's being grown today here in the States, and that is to say that since we've had hemp locked up, who's really producing hemp today, and is it really true hemp? And the answer to that is 100% no. Most of the hemp grown today, they call it hemp, but it is nothing more than a marijuana hybrid. To get CBD levels up, you marry marijuana with hemp, and you produce these strains that they are calling hemp, which both in USDA's eyes and FDA's eyes cannot be justified. This is not what hemp looked like hundreds to thousands of years ago. And by the way, people need to understand these are genetically manipulated. So you want to find out what strains were used and whether those strains have been used in humans for decades. The second thing that you want it to be is organic. We now know that the marijuana industry is plagued by pesticides and herbicides. It's not going to be much different here. So you're looking for organic. You're looking for non-GMO, which is going to be another thing that plagues growth here in the United States, whereas in Europe, GMO in a lot of countries is banned. Kosher certified would be nice. You would also want third-party independent assays to test for purity and potency. So you want to see the chromatogram to make sure that they're not using a marijuana hybrid, because you could look at certain things and tell whether or not they used marijuana. You want to look at the pesticides and herbicide values. You want to look at heavy metals. You want to look at microbial contamination. You want to look at whether or not it has solvent residues. A lot of the marijuana hybrid people are using solvents to get the THC down, and there's going to be residues there. So these are the things that we tell people to look for and ask for, because it's not necessarily going to be on the bottle, but you should demand it from companies to give you an affidavit of the strains being used, an affidavit that they've been used in humans for decades, third-party assays, a full chromatogram on the oil that's been used to make the product, full third-party assays for pesticides, herbicides, heavy metals, and microbial contamination, a non-GMO statement, and an organic statement. Once you get that, you're in good position. And I only tell people to do this homework because right now the laws have not been written yet. We know that the government is, especially the FDA, is asking for comments and what have you, and has not come out with rules and regulations. And so we're not completely protected out there as consumers. And I say consumer beware situation unless you ask for these documents that you can discern between, A, whether or not you're getting true hemp or some genetically manipulated plant, or B, is it a clean plant? Is it free of pesticides and herbicides and heavy metals and microbial contamination? Is it non-GMO? Is it organic? And then and only then can you make an educated decision.
Wow. Well, that's a really comprehensive overview of the whole story. Well, Carl, you've done such amazing work in this field for so long, and just have covered such important points. Let's just review, because you've given us so much information. So first of all, the endocannabinoid system, which really is relatively new in its discovery, which is quite amazing that such a fundamental system in our body was only discovered in the 1990s, considering its widespread application in all facets of our health. Isn't that amazing?
Right.
That we never knew it even existed. We're, you know, trying to find, understand the other systems of our body, but the main coordinating system that regulates all the other systems was never even identified, didn't even know it existed until the 1990s,
and it's both a tragedy and a travesty, and the reason being is because of the stigma attached to cannabinoids. So how can the government tell you, oh, you know, cannabinoids are like LSD and heroin, have no medical value. Oh, and by the way, you produce them in the body and your body feeds off of them. You couldn't tell that story. But the travesty and tragedy is the way it hampered education. I mean, this is a physiological system that's been in our body since the beginning of time, and you're telling me it's not taught in high school, it's not taught in college, it's not taught in practitioner school? This is mind-boggling. This is like me telling you, you know what, for the next 80 years, we're not going to teach the cardiovascular system as if it never existed. I mean, it's beyond mind-boggling, but slowly but surely, it's being dismantled because of the stigma.
So it's created this quantum leap of understanding, and not just understanding, but a quantum leap in the application of these phytocannabinoids for all these conditions. You know, one of the most amazing things that I found about one of the effects and benefits from these phytocannabinoids is the ability to go travel backwards up the neurons and distinguish the memories and thoughts that have been traumatic, but not the healthy memories, only the traumatic memories, which is why it helps with post-traumatic stress and other traumas. That's That's unbelievable, right? Isn't that, that's just so phenomenal.
Yeah, they're called retrograde neurotransmitters. So anandamide and 2-AG, the cannabinoids we produce, they kind of sit in the back, and then when things get out of control, they go from the what we call postsynaptic neuron, the brain cell that's getting the information, and they jump to the presynaptic neuron to say, hey, enough. They are controlling in that way. So unlike neurotransmitters that go in one direction from the presynaptic neuron to the postsynaptic neuron, these neurotransmitters go from the postsynaptic neuron to the pre to control things, and that's a good thing because it's not just aversive memories they're extincting. They're controlling the release of further damaging compounds like glutamate from going down the line, or the excitatory neurotransmitters that are causing anxiousness and what have you. So they're more regulatory, which is a good thing.
So the question that I have for you is, so this endocannabinoid system is so fundamental in maintaining balance and harmony in all the other systems of our body. What else can support a healthy endocannabinoid system? That's the first part of my question. And what are the conditions that actually deplete our endocannabinoid system?
Right. And there was a beautiful paper in PLOS One years ago talking about the care and feeding of the endocannabinoid system. And other than hemp and phytocannabinoids being the most important dietary source, there are other papers to show that, you know, carrots, hops, chocolate, echinacea, thyme, rosemary, clove, pepper, on and on, these foods have naturally occurring phytocannabinoids. They're in there in very minute levels, nothing compared to the potency of hemp, and why we say hemp is the preferred source, because you really can't get clinical benefit from eating those other foods unless you ate in tremendous amounts of them. So the point being is that the second thing I tell people to get over, not just that you produce cannabinoids, but you've been eating them, and all those foods that I just mentioned have been in our diet since the beginning of time that contain natural cannabinoids. But the most important dietary influencer of cannabinoids is your omega-3 to omega-6 levels. And when I talked about how omega-3 deficiency causes a deficiency in cannabinoid development in the body, is because the omega-3 fats are used as backbone structures to produce the cannabinoids in our body. So we have to be aware of our omega-3 to omega-6 status in the body. We have to eat less of omega-6, eat more of omega-3s, and if it means that you have to take a fish oil supplement, so be it. What we see in people who are omega-3 deficient, pain, inflammation, stress, anxiety, are the same things we see in people who are endocannabinoid deficient, and it's an intimate role between the two. The other things that are in this paper, the care and feeding of the endocannabinoid system, happens to look at other modalities that can actually influence the endocannabinoid system. They talk about acupuncture. There are certain acupuncture points that can trigger off the pain relief effects of acupuncture via stimulating the endocannabinoid system and the endorphin receptors. There is several papers that have been published to show certain osteopathic chiropractic adjustments work very well by, again, stimulating the immune system. There are relaxation techniques, whether it be yoga, meditation, what have you, that also influence the endocannabinoid system. So we know that lifestyle and epigenetic things out there can influence our endocannabinoid system. People who are under chronic stress, it depletes the system. People who take certain medications, as you get older, as I said, you don't produce enough cannabinoids. And so we have to look at other things besides hemp being at the top of the list of what we can do to keep our endocannabinoid system healthy. Because, as I mentioned, it wasn't until 2007 in the American Journal of Medicine, the paper was called The Endocannabinoid System, Mechanisms Behind Metabolic Homeostasis and Imbalance. What were they talking about? they were talking about from a big picture point of view, that if your endocannabinoid system is not working well, then you cannot be healthy, you cannot be well, you will be out of balance. And this balance and imbalance we're talking about is homeostasis. It's like, you know, the thermostat in your house. When, you know, if it gets too hot, it drops automatically. When it gets too cold, it goes up. Your body is constantly trying to make itself balanced because we are chronically imbalanced. Stress, anxiety, toxins in the environment, poor diet, exercise is a stressor. I mean, there's so many things that take us out of balance. Diseases, medications, the body's constantly striving to maintain balance. And you couldn't ask for a better system to work with than the endocannabinoid system to keep yourself in balance. And all these things are important. And so besides your diet, besides the use of hemp phytocannabinoids, you know, stress reduction techniques, whether it be yoga or meditation, acupuncture, chiropractic health, these are all helpful to maintain a good endocannabinoid system. And then we have complementary herbs like curcumin and boswellia, and all of the adaptogens, rhodiola and ginseng, what have you, that can help with homeostasis by helping the endocannabinoid system as well.
Well, that's great information. Okay, we have just a few minutes left. So one of the questions that there's one question just real quick. You talked about the need for omega-3 with fish oil. So what do you say to people who shy away from fish oils? They're vegans or vegetarians and they don't like their fish oils. What do you say to them?
Yeah, I feel sorry for them. because fish oils or omega-3s I find as one of the major foundation products that everybody should be on. So before I even talk about someone's illness or condition, I make sure that they are on the basic foundation products, a multivitamin, a probiotic, fish oils, and I can make the case for extra magnesium and vitamin D depending upon what people do. But after that, I would say phytocannabinoids in low doses act like a multivitamin for the endocannabinoid system. And so I think everyone would benefit from small amounts of phytocannabinoids along with those other. As far as vegetarians, I mean, there are algae-based omega-3s. So they're out there in the marketplace. So there's no excuse now for anyone not to take omega-3s.
Well, you answered the other question I had, which is it appropriate for people to be taking the phytocannabinoids on a daily basis, which you did. You answered that. You said yes, right? Small amounts.
Doses.
We can use it as a multivitamin. Yeah. I would imagine if you have more serious or chronic conditions or something acute going on with some pain, then you'd want to increase the amount you take on a daily basis.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. That's the way to do it.
Okay. In the kind of 2 minutes we have left, Carl, are there any contraindications for conditions or people who should not take this?
Okay. So I'm going to answer this with a caveat, and I'm going to talk about these issues when you take high doses of CBD, over 100 milligrams and more, which to me is completely unnecessary, but it's out there, and people play these number games, and you don't need you don't need anywhere near that amount. But for people who are taking over 50 to 100 milligrams, you have to understand that CBD and phytocannabinoids can influence the liver, just like a lot of nutrients we have in our marketplace. They influence the enzymes that can either break down a drug or keep the drug in the body lasting longer. And yes, you will find that at high doses, it influences the liver's what we call cytochrome P450 system that can have either effect of not breaking down enough of the drug or breaking down too much of it. So this is something you would have to discuss with your practitioner as to whether or not they need to, you know, be aware of, monitor, or adjust your medications, because that can happen with high doses.
So that's a caveat with high doses, and high doses would be over 100 milligrams in a serving?
Yeah, I would say, and if, you know, for people who are on certain medications, even at 50 milligrams on up, I would say just discuss it with the doctors, but we haven't seen it below 50 milligrams, any effects on the liver enzymes. So, by the way, the trade is in that 10 to 25 milligram range of being the target, and I am always of the opinion, and I've followed this all my life, that is, I'm not a single magic bullet person. There's no single magic bullet drugs. There's no single magic bullet nutrients. And even when it comes to the endocannabinoid system and the clinical relevancy of phytocannabinoids in hemp, it is clear to me that I would prefer to use lower doses and accessory complementary ingredients to address any condition in the body. So if I was dealing with inflammation and pain, yes, I would want to use the curcumin, boswellia, and fish oils and quercetin along with cannabinoids, and I don't have to go very high. If I'm dealing with anxiety, yes, I can use L-theanine, I can use lavender and chamomile and 5-HT3. I mean, there's so many things you can use as a complement to phytocannabinoids where you don't have to go at very high doses to have that effect. And it's true of anything when you get at high doses. They're going to have negative effects. We don't need to do that. We don't need to go there. This is not a numbers game, and you're not going to benefit that much more when you're getting at high doses.
Well, that makes sense. It's like putting together a protocol, so you're supporting a system with a variety of complementary components. That makes sense to me, which would give you even a better outcome as well, and then not have to risk the high dose to get the results. Well, Carl, you've done such amazing work in your research and your passion for communicating this amazing system and this amazing plant and the phytocannabinoids. I just want to thank you for the amount of energy and passion you have for the subject and really getting this message out there, which is making such a big difference in so many people's lives. So so thank you for the great work you have done and continue to do.
And thank you so much for having me. Thank you again.
Yes, well, it's been quite enlightening to have you on the show, and thanks for sharing all that you have. And to everyone listening, thank you for joining me, and I know it's been profound for all of us listening and learning about our endocannabinoid system and this amazing gift that nature has given us, the hemp plant. So until next time, I look forward to having you back with me, and remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.